Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 72 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 808. Okay, as I mentioned at the end of the preceding session, they wrap up this block of papers on civilization, and we go to Adam and Eve after this. They wrap up this block on civilization with a very fascinating paper, where it isn't so immediately philosophic as some of the material that we've been engaging in the previous papers. It's similar that, you're presenting facts. They presented a lot of historical facts, and you're trying to recognize the truth flowing through those historical facts. But here they give us facts from another world. Very fascinating thing to do. And lots of detailed facts, so that they're getting you to think about the science of government to a much greater degree, and in that space of having sort of a very separate example of how mortals have come up with a way to have a state, a territorial state that works for them, being able to have that contrast to reflect on and get to the deeper truths, right? I mean, it's obvious that they recognize that we have such a paucity of data to work with, it can be hard to reflect to the appropriate generality that you need.
So many of us think we're the only planet in the
universe. Right, yeah, especially if you start with the initial assumption that we're the only only inhabitants of the entire universe, yes. We'll see here in the preface how they're speaking to some of those immediate issues. Very, very interesting paper, and it's always great fun to go through here. And again, the challenge is the same as always. The point is not to just give you the facts. The point is to be struck by those facts in such a way that you recognize a truth that maybe is not as apparent as you reflect on our set of facts. So let's just...
Well, before we start, that's kind of interesting is that so this paper is talking about another planet, so pretty much everything in this paper has to be complete revelatory. I mean, there's not really anything that probably came out of the minds of humans, and which is interesting compared to almost every other paper where some of the thoughts and concepts, if this is, life on a neighboring planet, probably not much, if anything, came out of the thoughts and... of humans, so it's a total revelation
on this particular. Yeah, let's pause for a second on that specificity. There are times when it's important to remember that technically you don't have a revelation of facts. You have a disclosure of facts and a revelation of truth. So if you want to be really precise, they obviously aren't finding some human source work, and mining it for the, for the facts here. However, you want to be careful. I mean, how strong that mandate is that if there's a human that's expressed something in a certain way that's adequate, they need to use that. So they may have played off of human modalities of talking about things, right, and just put the facts of the other planet in that modality.
True.
Right. Anyway, your point is well taken. That you're obviously not going to find a human source work that talks about a neighboring planet, and the fact that it has, three divisions of its legislative branch or something, right? Yeah. Okay, so let's get into it here.
Paper 72, Government on a Neighboring Planet. By permission of Laniforge and with the approval of the Most Highs of Edentia, I am authorized to narrate something of the social, moral, and political life of the most advanced human race living on a not far distant planet belonging to the Satania system.
Okay, so you know they got three paragraphs in this preface. I mean, you know, it's all the same theme, but they're wanting to give you a little nugget at a time. So you see in this one right up front, they're telling you, okay, you don't do what we're about to do without serious permission. Okay, so you know that you know at some point probably in the preface they're going to remind you of just how uncommon what they're doing is. You've got Laniforge, you know the Lananadec that took over for Lucifer once the rebellion was over on Gerasim and the other architectural worlds. The Most Highs, of course, are obviously going to be involved because they're, not only are they still very intimately involved in a lot of the affairs of this planet because the rebellion isn't totally resolved, but they are also, independent of rebellions, they are the overseers of the integrity of all the local systems, all the worlds, within their constellation purview.
And Michael was here.
And they are the Most Highs. You got to get permission from the Most Highs, for this. Not to mention the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. You're going to be talking a lot about the kingdoms of men stuff. Right? So a number of ways that you can appreciate why they'd be involved. But you see, they're telling you right away there's distinct limitations despite the permission. They can narrate something of, right? So it's going to be circumscribed. It can't be too far removed or there no permission would be possible at all. It's got to be relatively similar to us. So yeah, it's in the Satania system. And as we'll see, it has a lot of closeness to us. So, all right. So they're giving you that thing. It's like right up front, seriously uncommon permission required fact we're about to give you.
Of all the Satania worlds which became isolated because of participation in the Lucifer Rebellion, this planet has experienced a history most like that of Urantia. The similarity of the two spheres undoubtedly explains why permission to make this extraordinary presentation was granted, for it is most unusual for the system rulers to consent to the narration of one planet, to a narration on one planet of the affairs of another.
Okay, so give me that again. We kind of already, yes, talked about it, but obviously, they weren't told directly that it was the similarity, but they're putting two and two together. It's like, okay, seems pretty logical. It undoubtedly, that's one of the main reasons they can do this. But you pause and it's like, okay, now, but why are they doing this? Think about on a normal world when you don't have a rebellion and a default. Even though the planetary prince and his staff and Adam and Eve and everyone aren't literally talking about another world, they are bringing in the essence of the other worlds in the local system into their ministry to the particular world they're on. They're giving you that bigger picture. I mean, that's the whole point of a revelateur is to bring a bigger context to bear on a local need. You can recognize right there, it's like, why? One of the reasons why they're doing it, there has to be some way that to make up for a little bit of that lack of direct helpers, giving you that bigger picture by just literally disclosing a lot of these details for us. Another little thing that you might think about between the lines there of why this, all of that aside, it's like, but still, is that enough to get permission? Because like they said, it is most unusual, okay? Not just unusual, but most unusual to do this. you know, there's a lot of worlds that went into rebellion. Yeah, you get the impression they didn't all get something like this. So even in that context. So what's another reason why it might be okay for our world to get information at a relatively early stage, you know, long ways before light and life, about another world? Well, what if, you know, our solar system doesn't have just a single inhabited world? So that in the normal course, you know, if there hadn't been a rebellion and default, just a normal course of affairs in this solar system, if there's two inhabited planets, right, you know, long before either of us get to light and life, we're going to be coming into interaction with one another, and there will be cross-fertilization with another world. I have a suspicion that that's another reason why, it's in general okay to do this. Because, you know, as it seems quite apparent, right, there we have another inhabited world in our system. It's that non-breather world that's out there in the remote, you know, reaches of our solar system.
Could that have gone into rebellion?
We kind of talked about that. I mean, it's such an artificial sort of a setup. It seems pretty unlikely that non-breather worlds go into rebellion. I mean, they're so informed at a very early age. It's hard for them to be clueless enough. But anyway,
you did say not far distant in the previous paragraph.
The reason that that's important is, you know, like we've talked about, it's obvious that they get to 1,000 inhabited worlds roughly in blocks of about 200. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the 200 are probably roughly, you know, geographically co-located, see? You know, and this is obviously a world that's part of our 200 group. You know, it's very close to us in its evolutionary state. Mm-hmm. Right? It may not have been an experimental world, but it's one of the 200, you know, in our group. It's not offset by hundreds of millions of years evolutionarily from us, you know, either in front of or behind. It's right in there with our group. So that's most likely why it's not too far distancy. All right, so you've got all that. So you can kind of, you know, get your juices turning a little bit about why they were permitted to do this.
This planet, like Urantia, was led astray by the disloyalty of its planetary prince in connection with the Lucifer Rebellion. It received a material sun shortly after Adam came to Urantia, and this sun also defaulted, leaving the sphere isolated, since a magisterial sun has never been bestowed upon its mortal races.
So, I mean, if we hadn't had Michael select this world for, you know, his seventh bestowal, we'd be in the same boat, most likely. See, wouldn't have.
Melchizedek would have probably not come.
You know, we wouldn't have gotten a magisterial sun yet either. Or, you know, you can see they got their Adam shortly after ours. You know, maybe, you know, it would be right around the time that, you know, we would have gotten the magisterial sun. And you know, maybe they're due to get theirs not too long hence, because, you know, we speculate that the magisterial sun may not be too far in the future.
Did they not get an Eve?
No, they did. They always get a pair. They're just, you know, you notice even in our case, they're speaking of it and just, okay. You know, they got that type of sun ministry, you know, just speaking out in the simple terms.
They also defaulted.
Yeah, and so, you know, when they said this planet has experienced a history most like that of Urantia, I mean, yeah, right. It wouldn't be close enough if they weren't a rebellion in a default world also. You know, not to mention not having a magisterial sun yet either. So all of it combines together to make it quite parallel in terms of what kind of events. And then you see the fact that they say shortly after we got our material sun. I mean, not only is it one of the 200 with our world that were all kind of spun up at the same time, but it's very, very close. I mean, you know, you're talking about just centuries of differential, as you'll see as we get into it, you know, about you know, when we got to a certain point and when they got to it, or, you know, I mean, we're very, very close, you know, in some ways kind of overlapping, or one of us is plus or minus, you know, 200, say, years, you know, either side of the other. We're very, very similar, which is just fascinating in itself that you can have all of the differences of evolution, like it's very, you know, probably not a decimal world, you know, and yet, you know, for the evolutionary process to roll out in such synchronized fashion like that, very fascinating. So, maybe just one other thought on that. It's like, well, why would it be so similar? Well, remember how close the genetics are, right? They're in Satania, this other world. Our Adam and Eve could have gone to their world and mated with them, okay? So the fact that our mind is attuned to our genetics are very similar, I mean, the evolutionary process is going to roll out in a very parallel fashion. Their thoughts are our thoughts and vice versa in many, many ways.
Surprising you could do that with the fact that we were different, having the Andonic race and the Sangix, you know, I mean, that's pretty unusual.
It is, but see, it's not... Fundamentally, though, it's not that different. I mean, it's a different way of, you know, it's taking the will creature and spreading it out in actual expression more. I mean, but what that's telling you is every world has Andonites, but not literally. The Andonites are eventuated within the Sangix. This one, they actually pulled them out and made them an explicit evolutionary expression, and eventually the Andites give rise to the Sangix. But it's just pointing out that every world has that Andonite nature eventuated within. It's just, you know, very, very rare that, you know, it plays out, you know, in a literal temporal fashion. You know, in the same way, you don't literally have to go through 450 million years from conception to, you know, to age six, right? All of that 450 million years is eventuated mostly in a relatively short chunk of time. But it's all there. The essence of all that 450 million years is there. It just didn't literally, you know, get downstepped and hence laid out in time.
To that, I wonder if some of the things they contribute to supremacy are, you know, have a benefit to our supremacy, influence, and some kind of cross talk.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and again, that gets you into these very deep philosophical questions about the completion of supremacy, about, you know, how much has to be literally out there, and why and how that comes to actually have some sort of a super additive consequence. I mean, it's not like we literally haul our Andonites to other planets so they can, you know, be an intimate, you know, relationship and there can be a super additive consequence. I mean, like we all get literally hauled to the central universe, you know, so that the perfecting can be face to face with the perfect and there can be a super additive consequence. It's not literally like that it, you know, you get supremacy fleshed out. Right. So exactly how does that all work, right? Is it the fact that the Andonites being literally, you know, manifest for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, does that feed into the mind energy system? Right, which then impacts the way mind is on a different world, and so there is a little bit of, even though they aren't physically there face to face, you know, there's an essence of mental juxtaposition or something. I don't know. You can speculate.
Maybe they're going to have exchange student program.
Right. I mean, you know, there are visitors, but but still. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, that's what they give you up front. They just, you know, give you that little preface about how this paper could be in your lap in the first place. It's not any sort of a preface about the details of the world itself. So now we'll go to the world, and you know, and you notice that they already hinted at what this section one is. Somewhere where they pointed out that there's the, oh yeah, in the first paragraph, you know, that social, moral, and political life of the most advanced human race living. So they're very constrained. They're just going to talk about one group, not everything that's going on the planet. All right, so let's go to that specificity here.
One, the continental nation. Notwithstanding all these planetary handicaps, a very superior civilization is evolving on an isolated continent about the size of Australia. This nation numbers about 140 million. Its people are a mixed race, predominantly blue and yellow, having a slightly greater portion of violet than the so-called white race of Urantia. These different races are not yet fully blended, but they fraternize and socialize very acceptably. The average length of life on this continent is now 90 years, 15% higher than that of the other people on the planet.
Any other people on the planet, yeah. Okay, so now it's very similar, but you know they don't say here, it's like, well, do they have the secondary sangiks? Is this a world that just has primaries? It probably has all six sangiks, you know, because they tell you it's so similar. But we do have just blue and yellow primary. So it's, you know, you're taking, you know, a relative cream of the crop in terms of the sangic stock. And it's obvious you're giving it, you know, on average, a little bit more biologic uplift from the Adamic stock than a lot of us got. You can just see it in the fact that at the end there, the average length of life, now remember that's, we're not, you're never talking about life expectancy when they talk about these things in the book. You're talking about longevity, right? The actual independent of environment, just genetic, quote-unquote, length of life on average. For that to be, you know, well above 70 years or by reason of strength 40, right, to be 90, right, on average, you know, not just the, you know, the leading tail, you know, of this, of the bell curve of longevity on this planet, you know, where you have relatively more Adamic in some peoples on the planet. Right, so this is a group that, you know, you would expect to have a relationship to wisdom and a sophistication of civilization a little bit more naturally, because of that little bit greater measure of uplift. See, and, you know, the whole back, the fact that it's like 15% higher than, you know, any of the other ones on the planet, you know, that puts it at, you know, around our neck of the woods, you know, that 15% less, right? That would be, you know, literally 78 years, right? And, you know, and that's the longest of the others. So see, yeah, the other peoples on the planet are probably kind of in that 70 years or by reason of strength 40. And these are sort of a cut above what we're used to genetically, these people. You know, that kind of gives you a little another hint, see, about why they would reveal about this particular continental nation. They're like us, but they're catalyzed ahead a little bit, so they're sort of like leaders relative to our genetics, you know, and can possibly serve in a little bit of a quasi-leadership capacity by reflecting on what they're up to, in the same way that the mortals on a normal world reflect on what the prince's staff and Adam and Eve and whatnot are up to, as sort of, you know, a cut above what's going on evolutionarily, and try to follow suit. So again, you see how it seems to make sense that they're making up a bit for the fact of the rebellion and the default. So you got something about the size of Australia, but you got a lot more population than Australia does. Okay, 140 million, you know, instead of like, you know, 25 million or something. And you'll see shortly, you know, I mean, Australia has a lot of desert, right? And this place is, you know, is much more temperate and habitable than Australia is in general, without having to go to great lengths to make it habitable. All right, let's see, what else do we have there? You do see that there's a parallel there, that even on this, in this, on this island continent, the races aren't fully blended yet. So again, you know, they didn't have an Adam and Eve to foster that blending, you know, in a relatively short span of time. It's just been going on like with us. And so it's spread out over a much longer span of time, even with all of their little bit greater consciousness. But they have a social structure that is helping a lot to bridge the genetic differences that are still there that we're struggling to have. You know, the E Pluribus Unum thing is having some difficulty here lately, right? To have a society that challenges the genetic differentials enough to rise above those genetic differentials and get along, instead of just having material gravity drag you down to your lowest, you know, mental nature, and having stark differences, you know, between the peoples. So there's a lot there. There's a lot there to reflect on.
No chance that this is just a three-race world.
Well, like I said, see, there's a chance. You know, but...
I didn't read all the way back. I was wondering if you probably read the whole paper, if they talk about...
Well, we'll see. I can't remember. As soon as I said that, it's like, well, I wonder if somewhere in the paper they actually allude to that. But I don't recall it.
Of course, it may not have been enough similar.
Yeah, that's my first suspicion is it probably has all six, just so that it would be similar enough. All right, keep going here.
The industrial mechanism of this nation enjoys a certain great advantage derived from the unique topography of the continent. The high mountains on which heavy rains fall 8 months in the year are situated at the very center of the country. This natural arrangement favors the utilization of water power and greatly facilitates the irrigation of the more arid western quarter of the continent.
Okay, so the prevailing winds on this continent are from the west or from the east?
West, I guess.
No, I mean,
the
leeward side of the mountains are dry, right? They're telling you that the leeward side is the west.
Oh, so it's coming the other way.
So they're easterlies. The prevailing winds are easterlies.
You can, like Hawaii.
You can interpret that, see?
Let alone, it's not a non-breather.
Right? They're definitely not non-breathers, yep. And but you see, it's like, oh, wow, this is really handy. You've got the mountains right in the center, and you've got all this rain, and so, and it can just come down the mountainside in every direction. It's, yeah, this is going to work very well for having it, being able to support a population of 140 million instead of like Australia is.
Right.
Okay. So you can put all the pieces there together really easily. Let's see. You know, and they would be, you know, not so dependent upon fossil fuels, you know, in many ways, because they have such an immediate foundation of water power, you know, everywhere around. So you can go, wow, this is like set up to for them to really live apart from the benighted masses on the other continents, as they're about to point out here in the next paragraph.
These people are self-sustaining, that is, they can live indefinitely without importing anything from the surrounding nations. Their natural resources are replete, and by scientific techniques, they have learned how to compensate for their deficiencies in the essentials of life. They enjoy a brisk domestic commerce, but have little foreign trade, owing to the universal hostility of their less progressive neighbors.
Okay, so so there you see, it's pointing out very directly that they don't need to have any connections with these benighted masses. They've got everything they need in terms of natural materials and whatnot. Especially once they got a little more sophisticated in their scientific, you know, knowledge, as they point out there. You know, but think about it. It's like, okay, you know, we don't want to get lost in all of these, just these facts. You know, what are we? You should be getting a sense of a parallel here. It's like, oh yeah, you know, there has been a tendency over the years that the United States has been in existence for there to be a growing envy and hostility and suspicion and whatnot of this country. You know, many call us the Great Satan, right? A universal hostility of their less progressive neighbors. So again, you're seeing why they can give you, why they were allowed to give us this. Again, because it's not just parallel to our planet, but see, specifically what they're going to give us is parallel to the leading edge of civilization on this planet. It's, you know, what they're going to give us is immediately relevant to the United States.
And maybe a few other places.
Right, that are trying to kind of catch up with the leading edge, you know, that the United States embodies with having three branches of government, and everyone is trying to kind of catch up with that still. Yeah, so that's, you know, you see very, you know, very clearly, again, why they're limited the way they are and who it's directed at. The fifth epical revelation is not a dispensational revelation. It's not meant for everyone. Just like they're not revealing everything on that other planet. It's, you know, the fifth epical revelation, it's epical but not dispensational. It's, you know, it's sweeping, but it's specifically for those who are on the leading edge philosophically and are ready to have where they are clarified, coordinated essential knowledge, and then fostering the recognition of truth that flows through that coordinated state forward into a more advanced future. Okay, it's not, the fifth epical revelation isn't immediately focused on how do you help foster, you know, the people in New Guinea that are just recently coming out of the Stone Age.
But in a thousand years.
Right, eventually, right. It all comes around. Whereas what Jesus was trying to do, if the apostles hadn't, you know, turned it into a very specific, enculturated thing, if they'd kept it transcendent in general, right, it was meant for everyone, the most advanced people in the most advanced countries and the least advanced people in the least advanced countries. It was meant for everyone. It was meant for those people just coming out of the Stone Age who, you know, just recently discovered there was someone else on the planet besides them.
So you're saying in a way that the fifth epical revelation is two revelations? Is the fourth and the fifth?
Well, no, I mean, it helps you to recognize just the simple core of what Jesus was trying to do so that you can take it out of that that confusion that the apostles put it into. Right. I mean, it all boils down to the last paper, right? I mean, you know, the name for the fourth epical revelation is not the teachings of Jesus, and it's certainly not Michael of Nebadon, right? The name of it is Jesus of Nazareth, right? The faith of Jesus is the revelation, right? You are to take on that very faith, not some low-grade, downstep variation of it, that very faith, which you can, as the first section says, we're talking about the faith of Jesus the man, not the faith of Michael of Nebadon, right? Talking about Jesus the man. You are to embody that faith and take it out into the world. You're not supposed to take out a book about what he was, you know, he was doing. That's why he purposely didn't leave a book, you know? You're supposed to take out your faith. Right. I mean, with the first and second epical revelations, those are teachings, not the fourth. You know, it is Jesus himself, his faith, that is the revelation. Right? Remember, you can't look up the proper definition of the word faith in the dictionary. That needs to be revealed to us, right? We need to reflect on him, and it's like, you know, there's something there besides belief. It seems like there's something behind his belief. I mean, it appears that there's just a belief, but my insight's telling me there's a reality behind the appearance of Jesus. There's a reality behind the belief. What do we call that fact that's behind the belief? Let's call it faith, right? The validation that's behind a certain kind of belief. You know, and if you go out into the world, not just with another belief, the world doesn't need yet another belief system, especially one that appears to be randomly pulled out of nowhere. We got plenty of those, you know, especially now that we have the internet. They're a dime a dozen. Right? What the world needs is something that it's never seen before, some significant number of people where it's obvious that there's something besides a belief there. There's a reality behind them that is deeply inspiring and then challenges me to take it up a notch. I want to have a rock-solid validation like that person. I'm building on sand. He's obviously built upon rock. Right? There's a validation behind his beliefs that I don't have. I want that. I'm going to seek that. And that's the fourth epical revelation, that there's something behind belief. Faith.
You get a little of that paper, 100, 101, and 102. I mean, they talk.
Right. I mean, right. You actually have the first time the actual genuine definition of the word faith is in the religion papers, for instance. It's not what you see in the dictionary. But anyway, right? See, and that's, you know, to have faith, to be challenging individuals to take a hold of their spiritual birthright, the nucleus of that spiritual birthright, your faith nucleus, right? All it takes is a human. You don't need any spirit of truth. You don't need any thought adjusters. All you need is the encirclement of the Holy Spirit and a personality. And you got everything you need. The most primitive human has that. You know, no matter if they're still in the Stone Age, right? They have that. And so you can encourage them taking hold of their spiritual birthright. That's the fourth epical revelation. The fifth, you know, including part four, which is part of the fifth, is all the details of the teachings and all that. It's not just, you know, they're words on pages. It's not Jesus. He's not there. It's just words on pages, right? And certainly his faith is not there. So you can see here that, you know, again, how this is tied to the selectiveness of the fifth epical revelation. There's a few on this planet for whom it doesn't have to be sad to record, and they need to be encouraged to take hold of a lot more than just their faith nucleus. Matter of fact, you're assuming that they have the faith nucleus definitively, and you're going to now come into relationship with the sphere of truth around that faith nucleus, something that some Stone Age primitive can't even remotely do. Right? It's everything they can do to get a hold of the faith nucleus. But you've got a people here with more genetic uplift. It's more immediate for them to be able to not only get a hold of the faith nucleus, but to begin to develop a society predicated on the conscious awareness of the sphere of truth about that nucleus. What was that?
I said, I wonder if they got a book, too. You never know.
Well, you know, when you get to the end of this paper, you know, you're wondering, it's like, well, either they need the magisterial son quickly, or they do need this precursor to the magisterial son, a book like this. Yep. All right. We were
on this continental nation, mm-hmm. in general, followed the evolutionary trend of the planet. The development from the tribal stage to the appearance of strong rulers and kings occupied thousands of years. The unconditional monarchs were succeeded by many different orders of government, a board of republics, communal states, and dictators came and went in endless profusion. This growth continued until about 500 years ago, when, during a political fermenting period, one of the nation's powerful dictator
triumvirs
had a change of heart. he volunteered to abdicate upon condition that one of the other rulers, the baser of the remaining two, also vacate his dictatorship. This was the sovereign. Thus was the sovereignty of the continental of the continent placed in the hands of one ruler. The unified state progressed under strong monarchical rule for over 100 years, during which there evolved a masterful charter of liberty.
Okay, so, so that even though they're in this very a delightfully helpful environment for natural resources and whatnot, doesn't mean they didn't have to go through the whole rigmarole. You start with clans, go through tribes, all the chaos of that, all kinds of warring and whatnot, and you know, eventually you start moving towards a nation, and you do it through monarchical. But they're pointing out you have all these fits and starts. You have abortive republics. You know, they get the notion, oh, maybe we should go forward to communism. Yeah, like we've had the idea. It's like, no. Because, see, they'd forgotten, too, about how that's the most primitive thing. And so they experimented with communal states. And but eventually, it started to kind of coalesce again. And they got into this triumvir mode, you know, which literally means three men. Right, the ver part is man. So you have three men ruling together. You know, kind of like you have three ancients of days, you know, ruling together. But right there, he's like, oh, okay, it's obviously, definitely, you've got father families and, males are very definitively, you know, in the leadership positions on this world. But you've got three different dictators here, who knows? You know, maybe there's three different parts of the geography of the island continent that they kind of, you know, have split it up or something. They don't explain that, but. There's one of a higher mental quality that recognizes that they need to get this consolidated if they're going to be able to go forward. There's no way forward with this divided leadership. And so the leader one, you know, the most advanced intellect looks at the other two and is like, well, you know, if I could get rid of this problematic lesser intellect out of the three of us. And so he convinces and has the guy in the middle intellectually take the reins. And through that, once you kind of brought things to a focus, look what happened. It just took 100 years, and they had a masterful charter of liberty formed. You know, so you kind of think, oh, that kind of sounds like, you know, in Great Britain. See, you can see there's that parallel. What came about in Great Britain is happening there. And you notice it's not masterly, it's masterful. Because these are people that need something to master them, to be master over them, to set up this Charter of Liberty that can actually take a hold of these people, because they apparently are having a tendency to fly off in lots of directions and kill each other and whatnot. And they need to be brought under control. So purposely say masterful there. So that's how they punched through to the precursor that we have in parallel here, you know, that led to the United States. Only with them, it's all happening on one continent. You don't have it happening on a different continent and going across the pond, you know, to here and whatnot. So that there's that difference. But it's in essence, it's the same process. And so they're going to come to a similar consciousness of a Charter of Liberty, but with twists, and that's why they're giving us all the details that they're about to give us. All right?
The subsequent transition from monarchy to a representative form of government was gradual. The kings remained as mere social or sentimental figureheads, finally disappearing when the male line of descent ran out. The present republic has now been in existence just 200 years, during which time there has been a continuous progression toward the governmental techniques about to be narrated. The last developments in industrial and political realms have been made within the past decade.
Okay, so this is very much
like England.
Right. You can see a number of things. Maybe let's just go through it in sequence. You can that whole bit of the kings remaining as mere social and sentimental figures. You know, not only Great Britain, but Europe in general. Is moving into that mode where they're just figureheads. You know, the nostalgia is just too great. You know, and the tradition is too great, and they hang on. But notice the interesting thing. That we, unlike here, where we're more enlightened here, and we've decided, we could keep these figurehead rulers, monarchs going, if you allowed the daughters and not just the sons. We've decided, but they didn't do that, and that actually helped because then they just died out quicker.
Yeah,
we're sort of belaboring the transition. By allowing the daughters to be queens and be monarchs too, so that's an interesting little between the lines there. And again, just see how similar the present republic has now been in existence for just 200 years.
Yeah. How long have we been?
Right. Yeah. You think back to the beginning of the 20th century, back to 1776. I mean, just look how similar. See, the timing is very similar. And it's been a work in progress to fine tune the details of this republic, of this representative government, all the way up to the time of the writing of the Revelation. And we get later in the paper, we'll see a little bit more about what's happened since the writing of this Revelation. Some interesting things along that line, but just, the hot off the presses, the ink is not even dried yet nature, some of the things that they're disclosing in here, right? That those people had barely thought this out, and we know about it now, which is kind of a cool thing. All right. So, so now they're going to get into the details, and it's, like they said, it's all just about that continental nation. We're not going to get any details. It's like, well, what's the state of a government, on one of the other continents? Or, they're just going to give us the details that are immediately relevant to who the target audience of the fifth epical revelation is. I mean, there might be some things on those other continents that might be relevant to some of the people that are still back in the earlier stages on this planet, but they're not giving us that. It just reminds you of the nature of the fifth epical revelation. Okay.
2, political organization. This continental nation now has a representative government with a centrally located national capital. The central government consists of a strong federation of 100 comparatively free states. These states elect their governors and legislatures for 10 years, and none are eligible for re-election. State judges are appointed for life by the governors and confirmed by their legislatures, which consist of one representative for each 100,000 citizens.
Okay, so now that we're getting in this, now you see we're really getting into the science of government here. And we don't want to belabor it, but unlike many things, the science of it is a lot more of the point here. So we do need to pause and think about some of these details, about why they're doing what they're doing. So you start out, right, it seems very logical to put the national capital towards the center of the island continent. They did just what we did in the United States to try to help to deal with diversity, not only of the environment, the landscape, but the people, that tend to attune themselves to different landscapes. So they don't just have one state; they break it up into states. So it's a United States sort of a concept there too. And they have something that's sort of in the ballpark of our magnitude, but you can see that it's. Because you know, they've been from north to south to east to west on this island continent, you know, for, you know, since the dawn of their history. They're doing this all at once. It's like, okay, we're, you know, we're not going to start out with a few states and eventually we end up with 50, right? I mean, they're picking this decimal number, right? I mean, they're just taking the whole continent right from the get-go, carving it into 100 states. And, you know, and when you think about that, you only have 140 million people.
Which is about, right? What we had at that time.
Yeah, right. It is, but it's still, it's, you know, it ends up being, it's like, you know, if you have only one representative, you know, and it looks like they have a unicameral legislature at the state level, see, it kind of appears, which would make sense. You know, it would be kind of like more like having just the Senate, sort of a state Senate, rather than also representatives, because if you have just one for each 100,000 citizens, right, I mean, you're not going to have that many.
1,400?
No, I mean, no. I mean, you got to divide 140 million into 100 first. You got 1.4 million.
And for every 100,000 citizens, they have one representative, right?
Yeah. And you only, and, you know, let's say, you know, you have 1.4 million citizens in the state. See, we're taking all of its 140 million.
Right.
And you divide that by 100, you know, just to be back of the envelope about it. So you've got 1.4 million per state.
Citizens.
So that's 14 representatives.
14 representatives.
See?
But
at the state legislature, in the state, right, legislature.
But times 100 states is 1,400 total.
Yeah, but no, here we're not talking about the national legislature. We're talking,
okay,
about the state legislature.
Okay,
I gotcha. See? And if you think about, like, say, think about the, you know, Colorado, you know, House and Senate. Mm-hmm. You know, 100,000 per representative. You know, that's kind of in the ballpark, in be, you know, sort of in between what we have per state representative or per state senator. See, so you can see it's the same basic idea that we've come up with, something in the neighborhood of 100,000 per representative.
Though ours is more territorial than.
Right, right, yeah. It's, you know, got all these differences. But you can see there's a similarity of the way the state works. But, you know, you're just seeing the fact that you could, you know, you have so few citizens relative to what we have, you know, have now, it probably makes sense to just have a unicameral state legislature instead of a bicameral one. Okay, and now think about, how do they handle this whole term limiting, blah, blah, blah? It's like, you know, just forget about all that, right? Right? They elect their governors and legislature for 10 years and none are eligible for re-election, period. Right? So instead of dealing with all the complexities of, you know, people getting re-elected and re-elected, see, they recognize the problems of that. So right up front, they just cut that off. No re-election, but let's just give them a longer one term. And eliminate the whole rigmarole of re-election and people getting entrenched, you know, turning it into, you know, their profession. Their, right, so you can see how they put a lot of wisdom up front into the way they set this up. Things that we could obviously leverage off of. You know, we're in the midst of getting wrapped around the axle because we didn't set it up like that to begin with and let it be more open-ended. You know, and just having, you know, all of, you know, the governors and the legislators, just all in the same schedule, just keeping it very simple but effective. 10 years is plenty, you know, and you go, well, wow, 10 years, though, on the other hand, is kind of long. Oh, so they must take this pretty seriously. If you sign it to be legislated, it's just not going to, I'm just going to do it for 2 years and then I'm out of there. No, you're signing up for 10 years. And so, you know, people who know the paper know that this is a very serious thing for them. You know, this isn't just some uneducated doofus that ends up being a state legislator. Okay, so all of that, see, there's all of those details are there. You can see how they immediately can be reflected on in contrast to what we're up to. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we should adopt exactly what they've done. Maybe, you know, maybe we need to think about, well, why didn't we set it up very definitively like that to start with? Well, I should go back and read the Founding Fathers' writings and stuff. And right? We need to reflect on why we did it the way we did. You know, maybe we had some reason. Maybe this was thought through. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe that kind of just fell through the cracks.
Maybe we didn't know.
Right? But see, they're wanting you to get into the details of this paper. This is for, you know, this is lots of material for someone who wants to get into the nitty-gritty details of the philosophy and science of government. And, you know, and wants to actually, you know, take that bigger and more precise perspective to governmental service and foster the evolution of our government. Okay? So that it's capturing more of the truth of government than we currently capture. I mean, you know, if we're capturing all the truth in our current forms, we wouldn't have all of these difficulties that are cropping up. It's like, well, that's unfortunate. That's getting abused and that sort of stuff. That's obviously because there's some threads of error in what we're doing right now.
Design issue.
Yeah, it's a design issue. Okay, what else do they give us here?
There are 5 different types of metropolitan government, depending on the size of the city. But no city is permitted to have more than 1 million inhabitants. On the whole, these municipal governing schemes are very simple, direct, and economical. The few offices of the city administration are keenly sought by the highest types of citizens.
Yeah, right. We mentioned the highest types of citizen thing. And you can see, again, all of the thought that's gone in advance, how much wisdom they're putting into this. Recognizing that you don't want to create some vast bureaucracy down at the bottom here. So it's kept, you know, very lean, you know, simple, direct, economical, no fol-de-rol. You know, so there's just a few positions and only the best can meet the needs. You know, when you have lots and lots of positions, you end up, well, I guess, you know, there's no one but Bob for that job. So, you know, Bob takes it, and Bob is less than adequate to the position. Sorry for all the Bobs out there. I'm not picking on you personally. But,
1 million people only. I mean, what are they have to move once you get to 1 million? I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing how you maintain that.
And I was just going to get that. Yeah. So the bit about the city, you know, and obviously they don't want the cities to get too big, so they limit them to 1 million. But then bring that around, it's like, whoa. Well, if you could have a city getting up to 1 million, I mean, when you took 140 million divided by 100, I mean, one of those, you know, it's possible a state, most of the population could all be in one really big city. So some of these states, you know, might be quite urban, you know, and others quite rural. You know, and by urban, you know, the state is like mostly one city.
You know, you control the population of a city.
But of course, you know,
unless they have control.
Well, I mean, see, and that's the other thing. You know, the very fact that it's controlled like that. Oh, they've got a very rigid structure. You know, we'll see this, and you know, the more we get into it, a lot of the rigidity of some of the things they're doing, we bristle against. We need to remind ourselves, you know, that we don't want to get sucked into the Lucifer rebellion here too much. You know, you're not the boss of me. I mean, we have to surrender some of our sovereignty to the state. We have to limit ourselves.
Yellow style.
Right. You know, you can reflect on how much this is possible because of their genetics.
Just mathematically, you know, once you got to the million, you know, some of those people are going to have kids. I mean, or, you know, and so it just naturally. Yeah. So it would mean that, you know,
they're managing
obviously
it.
Obviously, it's not just exactly a million, but I mean, it probably somewhere.
But they're not letting people move in. You know, there's some buffer there. I mean, some have to die off before others can move in because there's children, like you're saying, and so they'd have to treat it very dynamically. And everyone has to agree to that. That's the social contract. Everyone's fine with it. You know, and you recognize why they're limited to that so that you don't end up with, you know, regions that kind of fall into squalor and stuff because there's just too many people and you can't kind of keep it all working together, you know.
I'm sure they're not, they could move, they wouldn't have to stay in that city necessarily. Mm-hmm. They could move to a smaller city that had room to grow.
Sure, yeah.
But the 1 million, there's just a lot of complications with larger populations, with traffic, with all kinds of things that would be neatly taken care of by limiting a population to a city to one day.
See, and is it not obvious that that's exactly, you know, it's mostly material pragmatism, right? It's just, if you limit it to 1 million, period, there's just a whole bunch of things you won't have to deal with. But if you just let it be whatever, you know, it's just like letting a representative have as many terms as they want. I mean, now you need to draw, you know, they recognized you need to draw definitive boundaries. Or order is just not possible, right? You're going to have to start to have very difficult order problems. Recognizing, you know, what's bite size and what isn't, not getting, you know, beyond your ability to manage something. You know, it's like, why isn't the 7 super universes, you know, 1 million times bigger than it is? You know, why is it only, you know, basically 7 Milky Way sized galaxies? Why isn't it a, you know, 7 million Milky Way sized galaxies? Because you can't manage something that big.
But there may be in outer space.
As a finite phenomenon, right? You can manage something bigger as an absentite phenomenon, but not as a finite phenomenon, right? I mean, you know that the super universe level is maximized. It can't be one bit bigger and be properly manageable. You know they've maximized it. Yeah. You know, supremacy is a maximization. Yeah.
It's got the best and right metrics already built in.
You know, we can imagine. I can imagine, you know, having, you know, hyperdrive or warp drive or whatever, and we could have a lot bigger. No, but there isn't such a thing. Right, I mean, you've got, you know, most of the beings can only move around at 3 times the speed of light. I mean, it can't be very big. It's going to be too big. Yeah. So those, you know, they recognize those basic truths, the truths that are of limitation on high. You know, they've recognized and brought them down below and put very definitive lines around things in their system. Okay, what else do they say here?
The federal government embraces 3 coordinate divisions, executive, legislative, and judicial. The federal chief executive is elected every 6 years by universal territorial suffrage. He is not eligible for re-election except upon the petition of at least 75 state legislatures concurred in by the respective state governors, and then but for 1 term. He is advised by a super cabinet composed of all living ex-chief executives.
Okay, so you see a very similar thing, only it's 6 years now, and it's just 1 term. They go, see, that makes sense. You know, if you limit to 1 term, it's going to be longer than our 4. See, you can see how they're thinking in the same space that we are. You know, we end up, it's like, well, 4 is kind of small, so I guess we need to allow 1 more term for our president, that'd be 8, you know. So, you know, see, you can tell, again, the mentality is very similar, and they end up kind of in the same space, but they implement it differently. Instead of having 2 terms, they have 2 4-year terms, they have 1 6-year term. They've got the fundamental prerequisite. 3 branches of government: executive, legislative, judicial. And if they didn't, there wouldn't be Paper 72. Right? the whole point is to speak to those places on this planet that have 3 branches of government and help them see about how they could fine tune their system. So again, who's this? You know, who's the revelation directed to? You've got, just like our president, there's, you know, all the states joined together. But, you know, you get the sense that they, you know, maybe you're just doing it straightforwardly without an electoral college-like phenomenon. Just universal territorial suffrage. And why do they throw in that caveat?
The last sentence?
No, not the very last one. You know, the thing about, you know, he's not eligible for re-election except, okay, because, you know, they've had a lot of history. They know that there could be a situation like maybe there's an extreme war situation with the other continents or something, you know, and you can't, you know, you need to have this individual carry through for another term to see this out. You can't go through the whole rigmarole of changing chief executives right in the middle of that, you know, and so, you know, 75 of the states, you know, chime in, if not 100 of them, as if it's a really obvious situation, right? And he's allowed to have one more term, but only one. So if you're going to, if you've got some issue like that, sort of a crisis issue, they're going to resolve it short order. They're not going to let it drag on and on. We've been at war for 150 years.
These guys have the kind of biology where a 12-year term is a reasonable term for... Even a guy who's pretty senior,
mm-hmm.
he still can get another 6 years with clarity.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the last sentence. Yeah. There is where you start to see something that is different about this, about these people, than anything we have on this planet. We'll see as they go on. They have, again, because of that little bit greater upstepping, there's an immediacy of a philosophic consciousness for them that none of us have. Because of that, they're much more attuned to having wisdom be fundamentally part of the system. Right. So, you know, the cabinet here, the super cabinet, right? It's of the wise, the living chief executives. You know, it's basically, you know, back in their primitive days, they would have gone through the council of the elders phase, just like people on this planet did. See, and they've carried the truth of that all the way forward, right? This is the new version of the council of the elders for them in their system, the super cabinet composed of all living ex-chief executives. The whole point is to not lose that wisdom, all that experiential wisdom, okay?
That's a good one for us.
Now, one of the, that also between the lines reminds you of the limited diversity, you know, of these people that we're talking about, so that it's a little bit easier for them to work together like that. You know, more and more, you know, this, when we change presidents, the former president, the last thing he wants to do is even be in the same room as the new president. I mean, they hate each other's guts or whatever. I mean, it's just these extreme dichotomies and things. Yeah. I mean, part of that is just because of, you know, we're trying to encompass a much more polyglot phenomenon, you know, literally polyglot, than they are. You know, there's shades of kind of Japan with them. You know, for most of Japan's history, a very narrow spectrum of peoples that have to be encompassed by their system. But anyway, you know, so they can do that, you know, have this super cabinet of the wise to help him out. Okay, so that's the, you know, that's the basic details of the executive branch. What about the legislative?
The legislative division embraces three houses. One, the upper house, is elected by industrial, professional, agricultural, and other groups of workers, balloting in accordance with economic function. Keep going, or?
Yeah, read the first two, yeah.
Two, the lower house, is elected by certain organizations of society embracing the social, political, and philosophic groups not included in industry or the professions. All citizens in good standing participate in the election of both classes of representatives, but they are differently grouped, depending on whether the election pertains to the upper or lower house.
Okay, so now isn't that fascinating? See, it's just a fundamentally different approach. They've got an upper and a lower house. So, you know, that the way that evolved in Great Britain and came over here and all, you know, okay, they went through that same process where, you know, it was, but the way they constitute that upper and lower house now, look at how different. And so on the one hand, you have the industrial, professional, agricultural, and other groups of workers, and then the social, political, and philosophic groups. And see, like they're pointing out, so when you're electing these representatives to these two houses, you know, it's like, okay, next month is the upper house election. And so everyone on the island continent that is going to be voting, but they're broken up into, okay, here's the industrial group, you know, here's the professional group. Yeah, but everyone is going to vote, but they're, all of the in the professional group are going to vote for representatives to represent the professionals, and all of the industrial group are going to vote for representatives to represent. Yeah. See, so it's modalities of living rather than just geography and stuff. See, you know, and much more sophisticated than just. I'm a Democrat and I want to vote for a Democrat to represent me. I'm a Republican and I want to vote for a Republican to represent me. You've got all of the sophistication of the philosophic groups, for instance. You know, there again you see, well, philosophic groups. Right? They're just much more innately a philosophic people. You know, and so, now it's the lower house election. So the same people, only you group them differently now, right? You know, now... You know, you have this group, you know, there's a philosophic group, and this group is a political group. Okay, so there you might kind of get the sort of Democrat, Republican, or whatnot sort of a thing in the lower house. But that, and that just reminds you, because like what they call lower and upper. So in industry, professions, those sorts of things, those should be transcendent of some of those like political differentials, like especially if there's like political dichotomies. So it's an upper house. See, so the same spirit of the upper is transcendent of some of the differentials of the lower house, but in a much different basic philosophy to how to set them up.
We have a lot of, well, for lack of a better term, I'm going to call them fringe organizations that are established to try to influence government.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it seems like they've kind of done away with the middleman and just said, well, let's make these people our representatives and everyone belongs to one or several of these groups. How would they do it?
Yeah, that's a great point that I was, I was just going in that direction. You know, so to step back, it's like, okay, what can we see about how they're avoiding problems that we're struggling with? We know how it's getting worse and worse and worse with the lobbyist thing, right? That industry, you know, is lobbying and trying to, well, just get rid of the whole K Street thing, you know, in Washington, D.C., right? Set it up fundamentally where, you know, industry is going to get directly represented. They don't have to get behind the scenes and do all sorts of sneaky things trying to manipulate it, you know, to their ends. No, it's all out in the open and up front. You have representatives directly, that are tied to you. So you can, again, it's easy to see when you start reflecting on how there's some wisdom here of just totally short-circuiting some of these very problematic elements that have built up in our system.
Pretty much untenable.
Yeah, I mean, it's reaching the point of just complete stasis and corruption. Yeah. So, you can see the wisdom they built in. Again, it's like, well, why didn't that? Well, there was a lot of wisdom in our founding fathers, you know, predicated on the philosophers of many, many centuries. You know, there was wisdom there, but there's an immediate genetic wisdom in these people that's greater. Yeah. Okay. And you can see it, how they've built this in.
Much more immediate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and, let's do number three here.
Well, plus the fact these are fairly new for them, too.
Yeah, yeah, of course, they're new, yes. So, but it's so, just, you know, they...
Maybe they were in a situation where, you know, they started out differently, you know. It's hard once you start out one way to change and go another way.
It is. Yeah, and you know, you saw they had all kinds of abortive republics and whatnot. Okay, they started out the, you know, an unfortunate way many times. But once they finally got focused, they could bring a lot more sophistication into it. And you know, you could imagine that we could evolve ours eventually to these ends. Oh, that's the whole point of Revelation, right? To help catalyze the evolutionary process. And so, you know, they're basically kind of suggesting, you know, think about something along this lines where you're kind of showing you where you will effectively end up anyway, but instead of going through a lot of problem and maybe so problematic that it all collapses and you have to start all over again, if we kind of give you a little bit of a sense of the truth of where you're going, you can guide it a little bit more consciously and not have to collapse or go off on too many silly tangents. You know, we don't want to have, you know, 50 abortive republics before we finally get it together. Yeah, we know how problematic it would be if this republic collapses for the planet. So it's not like there's another massive republic to take our place. Other massive things are not republics. Even if they stick that word in their name, right? We all know what it really is. Yeah, so, okay. And then the very definitive thing that they... Oh, you got something on the webinar?
Yeah. It's just real brief. Mm-hmm. John Stevens is wondering if you would know if these are three-brained type people.
That's another thing you could say. Well, maybe, you know, that kind of goes along with, are there just primary sanguics? But again, you know, it's so close. My first guess would be probably not. They're probably two-brainers. So that they, you know, it's just that they'll act a little bit like three-brainers because they have this more biologic uplift than we do. You know, the biologic uplift would have helped us to not get caught in the dichotomies that a two-brainer so easily gets caught up in. Yeah. Okay.
The third house, the elder statesman, embraces the veterans of civic service and includes many distinguished persons nominated by the chief executive, by the regional sub-federal executives, by the chief of the Supreme Tribunal, and by the presiding officers of either of the other legislative houses. This group is limited to 100, and its members are elected by the majority action of the elder statesmen themselves. Membership is for life, and when vacancies occur, the persons receiving the largest ballot among the list of nominees is thereby duly elected. The scope of this body is purely advisory, but it is a mighty regulator of public opinion and exerts a powerful influence upon all branches of the government.
Okay, so not just the executive branch, but the legislative branch as well has a very definitive embodiment of wisdom, institutionalization of wisdom, right? An evolution of the Council of the Elders. So again, you see how much they respect that wisdom because of their just genetically more philosophic temperament.
It's interesting. They don't have any direct power. It's only in an advisory role.
Yeah, just like the super cabinet, see?
They can make their influence felt.
Yeah, and where and see, and that wisdom, see, is, you know, they're pointing out where it most immediately effective is on the culture, on the mores, you know, that public opinion thing there, right? That, you know, everyone in the nation is looking up to them as the leaders of the more system, and everyone is working under that context.
Instead of Hollywood.
Yeah, instead of some random, you know, individual that we put up on a pedestal, right?
With
thing you looked at 5 minutes ago on the internet.
Yeah. It's all definitively institutionalized. And you see how, you get nominations from all of the kind of the head elements in the governmental system. And then from that set, you pick a replacement. Is it limited precisely to 100? And one little thing they threw in there, it's like, what are they talking about? The regional sub-federal executives. Well, that's what they're just about to explain in the next paragraph here. There's a little more complexity to the executive branch than what they've told us so far. But you can see they have a Supreme Court, the Supreme Tribunal. And again, you see that membership is for life. All right, so that
of course, in this case, life might not be too much longer because they're elder statesmen.
Right. Yeah, you obviously know that because they're elder statesmen. But because it's just an advisory role, they can let it go for life. They don't cut it off. It's like, well, if you get past a certain age, they probably shouldn't, have their hands on the reins. We're wrestling with this issue with the Supreme Court. Should those appointments be for life? They actually have the hands on the reins very definitively. They start to get a little bit mushy. They can't focus as well as they used to. Should they still be given, that much influence?
Yeah, your ranch foundation just went through this. They changed theirs to now you have to get off when you're 80.
Right.
So you're halfway in the grave anyway.
But see, just again,
generous.
The whole point, I'm just trying to stress, that I'm saying membership is for life. You're going, well, who cares how they've set it up on some other planet? No, what's the truth flowing there? They're trying to get you to reflect on all those elements. It's like, well, where do we have membership for life? Where don't we, trying to get you to reflect on those key elements. Okay, yeah, so now this more about the executive branch.
Very much of the federal administrative work is carried on by the 10 regional sub-federal authorities, each consisting of the association of 10 states. These regional divisions are wholly executive and administrative, having neither legislative nor judicial functions. The 10 regional executives are the personal appointees of the federal chief executive, and their term of office is concurrent with his 6 years. The federal Supreme Tribunal approves the appointment of these 10 regional executives, and while they may not be reappointed, the retiring executive automatically becomes the associate and advisor of his successor. Otherwise, these regional chiefs choose their own cabinets of administrative officials.
Okay, so just a little bit at the end, you see there's a little provision for wisdom, right at your side. Again, so they're very key on that. But you see, this is a very interesting thing they've done. Obviously, they knew that there was this possibility that this centralized federal government could grow into a vast, bloated, top-heavy bureaucracy like we have. Right, so they just short-circuited that right from the get-go. There's very limited stuff actually, at the Capitol. They downstep it into these 10 subsets of states, right, and have these sub-federal, where the bulk of the administration occurs. A little bit more closer to where the rubber meets the road, instead of way up there in some ivory tower with all kinds of theoretical imaginings, and everyone else has to just try to conform to these completely impractical rulings coming down from on high, right? Like we've got, or we're having a tendency to get into, right? So again, it's almost immediate. You can see why they did. We've experientially gotten to the point of difficulty and have the potential to learn by leaping, what they learned by looking, I'm sure in many ways right up front. Now, some of this, they told you there's a process. It doesn't all get totally instituted right at the beginning. They have some evolutionary, they're learning by leaping too. But it's obvious that there's a lot more learning by looking than we tend to do, because again, there's more upstepped.
Yeah, it said 200 years got him to this point.
Yeah.
So when they say his, they don't mean it necessarily. It's the old English his versus his or her, right?
No, you'll see. It's very he, very male.
In this.
Yeah. Right. It's a. Yeah. Things are in a very male state in many ways. You can't help but notice here. We'll see. We'll get eventually. We won't get to it tonight, but we'll get to them. Sort of explaining another reason why that is. There's some energies here that aren't there, that have gotten us a little bit ahead of them, in some ways too. Let's see, what else do we have there? You can tell it's all very upfront constructed. You didn't sort of just over time, it's like, well, these three states, maybe we could kind of have them coordinated together into a group and these seven over here. No, it's all set up. You have 100 states and they're broken into 10 groups of 10 states. So they have a very decimal system set up. You almost wonder, it seems so definitively decimal that the 10 fingers is probably not all that's behind it. There may be some teachings from the prince and his staff, or the Adam and Eve on that world, about some of the tenfold stuff on high that they they're carrying forward very definitively, as above, as they were taught, so below. I can't help but suspect that there's probably, because remember, there's going to be all kinds of traditions carried forward from their planetary prince and their Adam and Eve, and maybe even with these peoples, they didn't lose as much of what came from the planetary prince, even though there was a rebellion, as we did. We lost basically everything here.
And their Adamic default may have been a little later than 119 years.
Think about how much the Andites, sort of entailing into the Sumerians, how much they were carrying forward some of that culture, of the prince and his staff. These are kind of like the Andites, see, on this planet, ending up as the Sumerians. Right, so it wouldn't be surprising if they actually know some about that stuff. They don't have to have a Urantia book plopped on their lap to tell them there was a rebellion and that there was a prince and his staff. I mean, they may know that historically.
That's impossible.
See, unlike we. Unlike our ignorance. So, did you have something?
It's just like you were saying at the beginning, how amazing it is that they're so close, and all of the evolution of all such a vast span of time, and the difference of the different dispensations and the different races happening at different times, and it all comes down to a difference of a few hundred years.
Or almost no difference at all. Temporally. It again reminds you of, like I said, of just how tightly synchronized things are, not only sort of naturally, if you will, because of genetic commonality, so that, it just can't help but kind of roll out at the same pace and stuff because it's just so genetically similar. We have to all be humble, remember, there's an awful lot of what I am that could be calculated in advance. There's nothing free will about it. If that's true of me as an individual, that's true collectively in the whole phenomenon. So it's going to play out in a very kind of mathematical way, in parallel on all these worlds that are basically initiated at the same time. And you know, and not to mention, there's probably also some over control, some guidance to help keep things synchronized, because you know you've got a complicated system. You know, the celestial authorities are managing, you know, who's coming into the mansion worlds. You know, that has to synchronize. You know, if things are too disjoint, it's not going to work. You know, so they're going to have to manage all this in a very complex way. You know, so you can imagine keeping things not so that they aren't too spread apart in terms of who's going into the mansion worlds. There's all the people in the previous block of 200. You know, they're all skipping over the mansion worlds. Now none of them go to mansion worlds anymore. Right. Haven't for hundreds of millions of years, right? And, you know, and of course the other block, you know, they're just moving up to be inhabited worlds.
They go there for 10 days, though, don't they? Even from the other ones or not?
They may go back to teach and stuff. But yeah, I'm just, okay. You know, if you jump way ahead, you know, you can go back and teach. But I'm just, you know, they're not feeding in this sort of bottom-up, you know, organic synchronization that they're trying to manage, you know.
Of course, they could balance that with lots of sleep time. Air
traffic control situation. Why don't all you guys sleep for a while right now? Yeah. But
you're just going to have to sleep because there's too many kinds.
It's too complicated, yeah. It's too much diversity.
You can only take 100,000. Yeah. And we got 200 billion here. We're going to get to it.
It's a big waiting list here.
Anyway, but isn't that kind of an interesting thing, this whole bit about the sub-federal, you know, to distribute the federal government vertically a little bit? You know,
they seem to trust one another more. They have a deference.
Yeah, well, again, see, remember, they're so similar. You know, they don't have such a diversity, you know, to manage. Mm-hmm. And with diversity comes suspicion, you know, as we all know. But so that's an interesting element that, you know, you think, well, you know, how could we use that maybe some to try to deal with this tendency to go to just this hopelessly top-heavy bureaucratic phenomenon like we're getting now? I mean, we know that the Founding Fathers tried to design it so that wouldn't happen. But, you know, you can see that these people, it's like, well, even if we sort of set it up so that's not going to happen, it probably would happen anyway. So let's make it so it just can't. We're just going to force it to be down at a lower level. So, let's see. What do we have here? The one other little thing that's kind of interesting there. Notice that it, you know, you might think, well, wouldn't it be like the upper house maybe that would approve? No. You know, who approves these? The Federal Supreme Tribunal approves the appointment of these 10 regional executives. That's kind of an interesting twist, too. You know, we often have the Senate doing those sorts of things, you know, in our case. They've actually got their Supreme Court justices doing that. Interesting twist to reflect on. You know, especially since this, you know, they're not, it's just executive, they're not doing any judicial things. So that, you know, that you know, there's a diversity, a sophistication to their Supreme Court that, you know, we don't have. It's a little bit more integrated into the system, you might say, there. You know, doesn't stand so apart. But, you know, the fact that, say, the regional chiefs can choose their own cabinets of, you know, and obviously there's probably lots of complexity, but it isn't all up at the top. All right, what about the judicial branch? I mean, we haven't gotten to them yet. What about the details of that?
What should I read here?
Let's see. Read the preface in number one.
Okay. This nation is adjudicated by two major court systems, the law courts and the socioeconomic courts. The law courts function on the following three levels. One, minor courts of municipal and local jurisdiction whose decisions may be appealed to the high state tribunals.
Okay, so I just wanted to read that a little bit first so you can kind of get the basic sense. So, until you read it all, you don't know exactly what they're referring to, but it sounds like at the beginning that it's set up fundamentally with a little bit greater complexity than our judicial branch. Yeah, so they have the law courts on the one hand and the socioeconomic courts on the other. And then we need to read about exactly how this is distributed vertically, right, in the hierarchy of the governmental system. But they very definitively have these two modes. Not getting those all, you know, muddled up together. And so you could have some you know, specialization of judges, you know, in this regard, and you know, which seems to
more like criminal and civil.
Right. You can see how they've got. We have some of these things, and in essence, the other thing you notice is that they definitely do have, you know, courts going all the way down to the municipal level, like we do. So their hierarchy goes all the way down. You know, we'll have, you know, municipal and county, and you'll see they have municipal and local jurisdictions, so they have districts apparently and stuff like we do. So it is a full hierarchy. They aren't trying to do this all at kind of the higher levels, and we've got that too. So, you know, we're not totally off base there. Okay, what about number two?
State Supreme Courts, whose decisions are final in all matters not involving the federal government or jeopardy of citizenship's rights and liberties. The regional executives are empowered to bring any case at once to the bar of the federal Supreme Court.
Okay, so again, you know, okay, they have state Supreme Courts. They seem to be kind of similar. You know, we all know that, you know, things rise up to the state Supreme Court, and that's the ceiling, you know, for a lot of things. They don't go on up, you know, into the federal system. So they have that. You can't help but notice how definitively they're stating issues of citizenship. You know, we all know how we're getting really confused about citizenship these days. You know, and we remember what we just read in the preceding paper. I mean, you can't have a state if you don't have citizens. Right? You can have a nation, you know, you can just have a people that happen to be kind of, you know, geographically, you know, located. Okay? But you can't have a state. You have to have citizens to have a state. See, so the degree to which we're getting fuzzy on citizenship, no, we should just be an amorphous people. You know, I mean, the whole citizen thing is silly and outmoded. It's like, no, that means you're guaranteed to, you're going to lose statehood. And you know, and we can see that where people are beginning to think in terms of tribes, right? I mean, if you're just people, then you're going to start to divvy up genetically and stuff, and right, you're going to have this tribe and, you know, ethnic tribe and this racial tribe and whatnot, just like we're starting to see happening. The citizenship has to be, you know, rock solid, definitive, nothing fuzzy about it. You're a citizen or you're not. Period. Okay. Or you don't have statehood.
Forget about social contract.
And then here you see how the complexity of the subfederal, you know, is interleaved into the system. You know, we saw how the Supreme Tribunal was related to those subfederal executives, and here you see the subfederal executives tied to the Supreme Tribunal. That they're the ones that can look at something that's going on in a state Supreme Court, you know, one of their 10 state Supreme Courts, and say, no, that's got to go up. You know, that's a bigger issue. You know, if others don't see it, you know, it's their position to recognize that and send it up, you know, at once to the bar of the federal Supreme Court. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, if you try to do something at once, everyone complains that there isn't proper process, due process, and, you know, you're trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes or whatever. Yes, howling and gnashing of teeth. and again, you see by them saying at once, that's just reminding you, I've pointed that several times, you can sense that there's a precision to what's going on here. You know, they're not allowing lots of fuzzy thinking into play. But like I said, I'm hinting at this. It's going to come around. There's a genetic thing to that too. It isn't just some sort of a self-control issue. They're much less genetically. They have much less of a genetic temperament to fuzz things out, like we're struggling with so much. Like, oh, it's like so individuated citizenship. Can't we just like blur that all into a unity? Right, our tendency to have too much unbridled unity consciousness, fuzzing things out. All right, so now let's get up to their Supreme Court here.
Federal Supreme Court. The High Tribunal for the Adjudication of National Contentions and the appellate cases coming up from the state courts. This Supreme Tribunal consists of 12 men over 40 and under 75 years of age who have served two or more years on some state tribunal and who have been appointed to this high position by the chief executive with majority approval of the super cabinet and the third house of the legislative assembly. All decisions of this supreme judicial body are by at least a two-thirds vote.
Yeah, so they've got 12 and you need 8. You know, rather than doing the odd number game like we do, where we end up with all these 5-4 decisions.
Yeah.
And how problematic that is to sort of the tensions in the mores system. You know, we all know we struggle with. So they've just set it up where you're not playing that odd number game. Where you can have these basically split decisions. So that's interesting. It's got to be definitive, and you see again how remember when we were reading about the Supreme Tribunals, how much wisdom is definitively embodied there. You know, and you see both of the wisdom bodies, needing majority approval to these appointments to the Supreme Court. Yeah, both the super cabinet and the third house. All right, see, so it's only the wisest of the wise that they're allowing to get a seat on that bench.
Here again, it's 12 men.
Yeah, see, and that's what I told you. If you keep reading, you can tell it's very, it's not 12 people, it's 12 men. It's very definitively male here, still.
So they're not, the two wisdom bodies are not really purely advisory. That's a powerful decision.
Yeah, yeah. But it's they're sort of just chiming in, advising the chief executive, about whether or not his wisdom is valid, in this regard.
It seems odd, this requirement of a two-thirds vote.
Mm-hmm.
What if they can't get two-thirds? Doesn't that leave them in limbo?
Well, see, you're left.
The Supreme Court.
Yeah, yes, it does. I mean, so.
Well, that's not unstrange because a lot of corporations require a two-thirds vote for major things to be decided. Yeah. If they don't get two-thirds, they aren't decided.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously one could reflect on exactly what the details are of their system in that regard. Do they have to just keep going around and around until they get a two-thirds, or can things be tabled, how does this work, But nonetheless, they're just giving you that one element, so because they don't want you to get too much in the weeds, because that's up to us. If we were to implement something that has this basic truth, the details are our details. But just appreciate that they're trying to bound the system away from these very problematic 5-4 decision things that that are so frequent in our system. When it's that close, you shouldn't, like you're saying, you shouldn't be laying down this definitive, universal, edict.
Yeah.
right? Because you just, it's going to put tensions into the people that are going to be problematic, right? It's better for the evolution to take it a little bit further until everyone is a little bit more of a kindred mind. If you're not of a requisite kindred mind, well, then just let it be.
What they say, last paper, don't go too fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. See, this would put a governorcy into it, a time tempering element into it.
I guess if they're taking a case from a lower court, they can't get 2/3. I guess it just falls back to the lower court.
Right, whatever the lower court ruling. I mean, you know, we would probably guess that it would be kind of like the appellate court thing with, you know. And I was just going to mention that. You know, notice that you don't see any signs of this whole kind of federal hierarchy thing that we have. You know, it really builds up more organically with the, you know, the minor courts and the municipal and local, you know, and then a state and then a federal, rather than these sort of, you know, parallel hierarchies with a lot of complexity about who has jurisdiction. Right? They have it kind of more cleanly stacked. If there's an appeal coming up to the Supreme Court, it's coming up from the state court, not from a federal appellate court. Yeah. So that's interesting too. And then the other big thing in there, obviously, is besides them having, say, 12 instead of 9 like we do, is they have to be over 40 and under 75. Okay, so no for life thing there, see. Mm-hmm. All right. It's like, okay, 75, even when their average is 90, even their average long, you know, when their average longevity is 90, 75, they're out of there. Okay. Why over 40?
Uh-huh.
The age of wisdom. See, it's right there. So, and remember, we've talked about that. Even though you know their years are different than our years and this sort of stuff, this is all synchronized. So that even though literally, you know, if you're watching sand grains fall in a, you know, in an egg timer, right? More will fall on their world to get to 40, you know, say, than on our world, right? It's in truth they're the same age, even though in fact they aren't relative to some clock on the wall. Yeah,
it's just like the age of 16 when you're
in
the
ministry. See, it doesn't matter what world you come from. It's 16. See, all right? The age of 20, the age of 40, these don't have anything to do with, you know, how many times a second hand go, you know, ticks to get to 40. Okay, so that's it speaks to this, how you have everything so synchronized. There's this paralleling of in truth, and it doesn't matter if their year is 5 times longer than our year. They don't get to the age of wisdom until they're 40. Yeah, so that's one of the fun things about the Revelation, about what they tell you about people on different worlds, you know, what aliens, quote unquote, are like, you know, that there's this commonality that really is kind of only there and poo-pooed, like in, say, Star Trek, where how come when the Enterprise goes to different planets, they all basically look like us, only, you know, with different face makeup or something?
There could be some differences, you know, in other universes. Local universes,
but they're all bipedal. Doesn't matter what super universe they're in, they're all bipedal. They all, yeah, right, you see, and they're all carbon based life forms. And you see, there's a commonality,
right? Michaels do have the ability to do, and if, as you said earlier, if we're mirroring some world in Havona, our system is, there could be some differences there too.
Right. But again, at this level, I mean, literally. Right, any Adam and Eve, you know, any material son and daughter on Gerizim can go to any world in Satania and procreate with them. They're that similar.
Yeah,
it's Satania. Yeah. Anyway, it just that the fact that there is that, you know, that it's not some random process. you know, like our science fiction stories are kind of predicated on. No, life is not some random process. And so, you know, here the, you know, the advanced creatures look like octopuses or something. And I was like, no, it's just, there isn't any such thing.
Cardassians may be, but...
Yeah. All right. So now what about that other branch of the court system here?
The socioeconomic courts function in the following three divisions. One, parental courts, associated with the legislative and executive divisions of the home and social system.
Okay, so just, you know, it's a pretty basic statement, but just notice the concept that's going on. So they haven't talked about it yet, but there's obviously some very complex element of this whole regulative structure that is the home and social system, okay?
Next paper.
And in that home and social system, there's executive, legislative, and judicial elements. See, just look at how sophisticated this is. And so the parental courts are the judicial branch or division in a three-branch specific home and social system. So they have, they don't just have an umbrella three-branch thing. They've got that distributed down in the hierarchy. So that's an interesting additional element, see, that they've carried that truth deeper into the system than we have. So, I mean, again, that would be, you know, to be expected. They would insightfully recognize the universal nature of that, they didn't just totally stumble upon that. I mean, they have a much more conscious recognition that that's an as above, so below. And again, that might be augmented by, they might have a very definitive history recorded of, well, our Adam and Eve told us a lot about the three branches on high. And, you know, so it may not all just be an experiential discovery, you know, with insight on their part, like it is kind of with us. You know, there may be a modeling there in their historical record that we don't have. But nonetheless, they have these parental courts. Okay, what about the other type here?
Educational courts. The juridical bodies connected with the state and regional school systems and associated with the executive and legislative branches of the educational administrative mechanism.
Okay, so they have juridical bodies for education. And again, you have this educational administrative mechanism. And it has executive, legislative, and judicial again. And of course, besides just that, they throw in one little twist here. You know, they haven't mentioned education much yet. And you see, so there's the state and regional school systems. So they, the educational system has a kind of a fundamental hierarchy. It's obviously going to be, you know, founded in the state. But there's some transcendent element to that that goes into this 10-state region. You know, and it's like, well, I don't know, is that like the university level? Is it the regional? And maybe up to high school is in the state? Or, you know, you're left wondering kind of what's that about? But you can see that they've got something going on there where they've distributed the educational system across that, you know, or above the state into that regional element that they've got built into their system.
Boy, look how that would just enrich how the one coordinates with the other.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's prepped to enter that higher realm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, see, yeah, obviously if it's kind of like what I was saying, right, the teachers of the state would then be coming down from sort of the college level, university level, you know, that has a innately transcendent scope, you know, that is then getting specialized down to a particular state, and is a downstepped expression of the truth. Yep, you can see with how they might be, why they've fundamentally set it up that way, how they would utilize it. Okay, but that's not just parental and educational. You got yet a third element here.
Industrial courts, the jurisdictional tribunals vested with full authority for the settlement of all economic misunderstandings.
Okay, so just for economic misunderstandings. You know, so in other words, there's, you know, the whole economic system. So you've got these three different systems, home and social system, the educational administrative system, and then the economic system. And all of them have this executive, legislative, judicial complexity to them. And you can kind of guess what it's probably going to say in the final paragraph there, the way they worded that, that it's vested with full authority for the settlement. So there's obviously some sort of definitive ceiling here. You know, that basically is not feeding up to the Supreme Court.
So which court do you think you'd go to for divorce?
The parental courts.
And the industrial? Economic misunderstanding?
Yeah.
Parental?
Yeah. All right, so then what's our final little...
The federal Supreme Court does not pass upon socioeconomic cases except upon the three-quarters vote of the third legislative branch of the national government, the House of Elder Statesmen. Otherwise, all decisions of the parental, educational, and industrial high courts are final.
So they're basically final. I mean, even more final than the state Supreme Courts are, you know, relative to the law directly. But there is that high, wise body. You can say, no, that transcends that that sort of circumscribed space.
Yeah.
You know, there's more there than just industrial. There's, in a sense, there's even more there than just socioeconomic. Right? In their very overarching philosophic wise vantage point, and they recognize that needs to go up and be judged by, you know, the final say in the judicial branch.
It has implications beyond the local.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and like I was saying, localized not just geographically but in terms of the social structure.
So the third legislative branch is the third house?
Yeah, the third house, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right, see, the House of the Elder Statesmen. That's why they threw that in, just to kind of help you with that. Right, so, you know, but it is, you know, it's a high bar. It's got to be 75 out of the 100.
You
can see how they're...
Can't keep appealing up
there. Yeah, obviously you can see how they're trying to keep things as direct, you know, as they can, and put some definitive lines into their system. You know, we have too many things where, you know, we can weasel out of something and it just goes on and on and on and on and this never gets resolved and just, you know.
Of course, they say somewhere else, they say that's a problem. One big thing about justice is if it's not fairly quick, it doesn't have any meaning.
Right, especially when it's capital punishment. Right, unless if capital punishment isn't very immediate, then it's not worth having. Yeah, you know? And of course, you know, that's, you know, we've talked about, you know, we're the antithesis, right, of that now. 90 years later, you finally get through all the appeals. You know, it's like, well, it's too late now. He already died of old age. You know,
all his DNA
didn't match
anyway, so now
you
let him go.
It's like, you know,
about evolution achieving one.
See, and again, you know why that is. See, we are way too biased, right, to our unity consciousness side. It's like, no, we can't ever do anything that isn't perfect. Okay, there is no such thing, right? You've got to temper that with some material pragmatism, right? He's like, well, yes, but I mean, what if I'm judged, thumbs down by those on high? What does it say in the Arantia book? That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. If you decide to execute that criminal, even if technically he didn't commit the crime, that decision is honored in heaven.
Should have got that at Golgotha.
That's very difficult for us to think this. Well, no, heaven would never be so evolutionary in their relationship to us. They would never be so. Yes, they would. Right? You're not being judged existentially, but we all think we are being. Right? So it has to be absolute and perfect, and right. There is no such thing. You do the best you can, and that's honored in heaven. And see, they basically understand that. It's like, no, this is it. Drawing the line. There's no appeal. Right? Done. And
they haven't had a magisterial son.
And they haven't had a magisterial son, so you give them that sort of philosophical uplifting. So again, you have to, you know from just what they say in here that definitely a lot of it's genetic. They have more uplift. You wonder if maybe there isn't a little bit of teaching coming down that they didn't lose from the first two dispensations as well.
I don't know if that means anything, but based on that gauge, our magisterial is a ways out. If we're going to gauge it from that. Their level of wisdom, and they're still waiting for theirs.
Right, you know, we got a bestowal son, so we have a spiritual uplift that they haven't had.
And a spirit of truth.
So you've primed the pump where, theirs hasn't been. Plus, right, this is a pre-magisterial son book, right? This isn't a pre-bestowal son book or a pre, biologic uplifter book. I mean, this is a pre-magisterial son book. It's a philosophic text. It can't be too far down the road that the magisterial son comes, or this will, this would not serve the role that it's obviously serving. It's trying to hold things together until he comes.
Kind of like the Melchizedek.
Right, exactly like Melchizedek, trying to hold things together until, Machiavelli and Melchizedek didn't come 30,000 years ago, right? I mean, there it's like, 2,000 years, and even then, that was, they were going, we did it too soon. We should have done it 1,000 years before Michael arrived instead of 2,000, because it's all going to be gone before he gets here. Yeah. You've got the spiritual quickening in the 6th century B.C. that that gave him a little booster shot, and so it actually made it until Michael arrived. So something, this could be looking like it's going to fail too, and then you could have the dawning of the seventh adjutant in the collective, and
a new John the Baptist.
Give it a little booster shot, and
2030, I'm holding up.
All right, but anyway, okay, so that's our little survey of the basics of their three branches of government. And you can see there's all kinds of interesting little details there to reflect on, and then they're going to get into. Stuff that's a little bit more immediately, to our personal doings here. Start with the foundation of that, the home. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.